Have you heard any good advertising jingles lately? Probably not, as the jingles pretty much go in the way of the dodo bird. But there was a time when you couldn't turn on a radio or a TV set without hearing such classics as "You Deserve a Break Today" and "Plop, Flop, Fizz, Fizz." Remember? Timothy Taylor spent many years studying jingles and other kinds of advertising music. Taylor's an ethnomusicologist at UCLA. He's also the author of The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. He tells Ann Strainchamps about the very first jingle.
Most radio scholars agree that the first thing that we could call a jingle was for 1926, and it was selling Wheaties. That was a pretty successful commercial, and it saved the Wheaties brand.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the brand. Won't you try Wheaties? For wheat is the best food of man. They're crispy and crunchy the whole year through. The kiddies never tire of them, and neither will you. So just try Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land.
But in 1926, nobody was thinking, oh, gee, maybe we can write original songs to sell goods and this will be a new thing. It was, you know, just something that Wheaties happened to do that happened to be successful. It wasn't really till the Depression, and well into the Depression, that one particular jingle that was written for Pepsi-Cola was aired. And that one, because it was thought to be so catchy and was listened to by so many people across the country, that the jingle as a sales mechanism became popular. And that was 1939, actually late in 39, and then the jingle lasted for decades.
So was that Pepsi jingle the first one to go viral, in a sense?
Yeah, that's right. And it was translated into 55 languages. Pepsi made versions of it to be played in jukeboxes. They were sort of popular song versions made of it. So you could go out and buy a record, a 78 RPM record.
So you write that at a certain point, advertisers and composers began to get even more sophisticated about how they used music for ads. And they began to compose music to deliberately manipulate emotion or convey certain ideas about products. For instance, you write about a famous TV commercial for Ford cars called Backseat Blues.
Yeah, that was written by the great Mitch Lee, who listeners might know better as the composer to Man of La Mancha, who started a jingle house, as they're called, a jingle production company in the 50s. He had been classically trained by the German composer Paul Hindemith at Yale. He and some other classical composers really wanted to make emotional appeals through music part of what they did. And that hadn't really been done before, believe it or not. I mean, all the jingles, all the advertising music that had been done from the 20s, 30s into the late 50s was almost always very happy, upbeat music, as if nobody ever thought about trying to make music that could be maybe disturbing at the beginning because you've got a stomach ache, but then you take the magic pill and then you have happy music at the end. And nobody really did that, which is odd because in the film industry, all they talked about was what music can do emotionally for what's going on the screen. But in the commercial music world, nobody ever talked about it. I read all the trade press. I looked at tons of archival material. I only found two or three mentions ever of people talking about music and emotion. But it wasn't until these people like Mitch Lee and some other folks in the late, very late 50s, all of whom had classical training, they come along and they say, well, wait a minute, you know, music is powerful. Music can do more than just be happy or be upbeat. And let's use what music can do in a more subtle way to sell product. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. And of course, that became the norm.
And what was Backseat Blues like?
Backseat Blues was a sort of a vocal jazzy track. It sounds pretty upbeat, the whole thing, from start to finish. But what Mitch Lee did is he changes the meter in it. So when you see people trying to get in and out of Ford's competing cars, and they're scrunching themselves up to do this, he changes the meter and it sounds kind of off. And he does this on purpose. But then when you get in and out of the Ford car, then you get a much, much more straightforward beat.
If the door's not for people, if the floor's not for people, if it twists the sacroiliac of people getting in the back. Definitely not a Ford. Definitely not a Ford. Cause Ford gives you headroom, stretch out. You got leg room getting in and out. You have more room. Ford is proportion for people. Ford is proportion for you. Ford, Ford, Ford is proportion for you.
This was one way in which he was trying to use emotion to sell product. By the 70s, it became much more sophisticated. Lots of different emotional nuances could be used, at least up to a point. In 30 or 60 seconds, there's not that much you can do.
The jingle, as such, kind of began to disappear after a while, and I don't think music is really used quite that way in ads anymore. What caused the decline and fall of the jingle?
Yeah, it was a workhorse in the industry for decades. What I write in the book and what is borne out demographically and you know, backed up by other authors is that when the baby boomers begin to come into positions of authority in the industry in the 1980s, in the advertising industry, they just thought the jingles were corny, and they felt like, why can't we use our own music to sell goods? And you begin to see the rise of the licensing of pre-existing popular music for use in commercials. Maybe most famously or infamously, the use of Beatles' Revolution in 1987 for Nike.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
That was a huge controversy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
What happened?
The surviving Beatles sued, but at that point they no longer owned their own music. Michael Jackson's company owned it, so they didn't really have much of a case for a lawsuit, if you ask me, although I'm not a lawyer.
All right. It's interesting. There's a quotation in your book I flagged because it either seems remarkably cynical or very alarming. You write that there is no popular music today that is not, to varying degrees, advertising music.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, it's partly because the power of the advertising industry is so great, at least in our media landscape, which is dominated by commercial interests, except for public radio, of course. So, you know, commercial interests tend to win out. But also the advertising industry exercises what I think is a sort of an outsized influence on the culture itself. I think the advertising industry's pursuit of the hip and the cool since the 60s has made us all, you know, everybody, at least in the U.S., sort of aware of the hip and the cool. What's the hip new show or the hip new indie rock band or whatever? So I think this ideology of the hip and the cool matters more because the advertising industry feeds off of it and pushes it back on us.
Well, to a certain extent, that's what we're buying, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you look at an ad, the sort of subliminal message often is, we're showing you or telling you what's hip and cool, and if you're hip and cool, you'll understand this.
Yeah, or, you know, you're not going to be hip unless you're in the car like these cool people in the car.
Wearing these particular shoes.
Right. And then also, for these technological reasons, it's much easier now for musicians to move between, you know, writing music for commercials, producing a band, or being in a band. This technology has kind of evened things out a bit. Some complain about that. Some people say that a lot of popular music sounds the same because everybody's using the same software, and I think there's some truth to that.
Well, I was going to ask you, is this good for music or bad for music? I suppose I'm revealing myself as a boomer when I think it sounds like the whole world has become commercial and music is just part of it.
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I think a young musician who wants to try to make a living off of his or her music is probably going to face greater pressures to compromise or do what we used to call selling out than they would have in the past. At the same time, in many places across the country, there's a thriving independent music scene. I almost said indie rock, but it's not always rock. Musicians who don't care if their music gets recorded or not, or gets popular or not. And then there's plenty of musicians who, you know, the music industry has no interest in, like people who just sing or play for fun and who have no ambition of trying to make money off their music. I think all of that is worthwhile. But I do think at the same time that the moment that you decide that you want to try to make money off of your music, the likelihood that you're going to be forced to compromise in commercial directions is greater than it's ever been.
The German engineered Volkswagen Golf. It fits your life, or your complete lack thereof. On the road of life, there are passengers and there are drivers.
Timothy Taylor is the author of The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. He spoke with N. Strange Champs.